Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program has been brought to you by Cane Vineyard and Winery, a Napa Valley winery committed to respecting the soil and dedicated to the creation of three Cabernet blends. For more information, visit cane5.com. You're listening to heritageradionetwork.org, a nonprofit, member-supported radio station. We're millions strong, with folks tuning in from over 200 countries. We are education. We are entertainment. We are the future of food. May is our membership drive. Become a member and support us while receiving e-newsletters, advanced invites, special discounts, and a membership card. We need your support. Visit our website and click the donate button to become a member today. Thank you for believing in us and enjoy the show.
Good afternoon and welcome to What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights with your host, Katie Kiefer. That would be me. We are broadcasting live from the back of Roberta's on the Heritage Radio Network. My guest in studio today is Dr. Urvashi Rangan. She is a PhD who leads and directs the Consumer Safety and Sustainability Group for Consumer Reports. She is responsible for managing risk analysis, policy assessments, label evaluations, and consumer advice for tests, reports, and related advocacy work. Dr. Rangan serves as a primary national spokesperson for Consumer Reports in the areas of sustainable production, consumption practices, food safety and product safety issues related to chemical and contaminant hazards. She continues to decode the meaning of eco-labels for consumers and advocates. We'll have to do a show on that, Urvashi. And credible labeling in the marketplace, including influencing government policy decisions at the state and federal level. Dr. Rangan received her PhD in environmental health sciences from Johns Hopkins University in 1995 and conducted her postdoctoral work at the Environmental and Occupational Health Science Institute. She was a National Institutes of Health Fellow from 1990 to 1997. Welcome to the studio, Urvashi. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Thanks a lot, Katie.
So you just published, and boy, given that I was just at the Animal Agriculture Alliance down in D.C., a big trade group summit meeting on activism, you published, coincidentally at the same time, a new report on ground turkey and antibiotic-resistant microbes that live therein. Can you describe the study for us, and can you tell us what some of the drugs were that you tested for?
Sure. As part of our ongoing look at ground meat and raw ground meat and looking at the safety of that industry as a whole, we had never looked at ground turkey. So we decided to do a nationwide sampling of ground turkey. We purchased like 257 packages of ground turkey and sort of put them to the test. We tested for a number of different kinds of bacteria. And then of the bacteria we found, we subject those to panels of antibiotics that are specific to those organisms in particular, sometimes up to 12 different classes for any one given organism. So it's several antibiotics, several classes of antibiotics in order to look at the patterns of resistance that are going on. And we found some pretty interesting results, actually. I mean, like all meat studies, we find some pathogens, we find levels of filth. In this case, we found significant levels of filth, E. coli and Enterococcus, which are measures of fecal contamination. We're running at about 60%, 69%. Salmonella was around 5%. Staph aureus was around 15%. But the real findings, I think, had to do with our antibiotic resistance profiles that we found. I mean, if you cook this meat thoroughly, those pathogens should not be harmful to you. But handling the meat carefully, making sure you don't cross-contaminate, those are all part of the deal in terms of safe consumption when it's that dirty. Most of them were resistant, or just over half were resistant to three or more antibiotics. That kind of makes them in the superbug.
Which antibiotics were those? Do you remember?
These are all human classes of antibiotics. So the antibiotic resistance panels that we use include all the human antibiotics that we use to treat human diseases. We're not looking for the specific drugs that are used in turkey production, but we did make some interesting observations in the drugs. So let's just talk about the findings. We found more than half were resistant to three or more antibiotics. We also had a sample pool that was significant enough to analyze on its own, which was meat that was labeled as no antibiotics or organic. So it was produced without antibiotics. And in those packages, we found statistically less antibiotic resistance in those bacteria than we found in the conventional ground meat. Very significant finding.
But did you see the same amount of contamination vis-a-vis enterococcus?
Yes, we did, actually. Uh-huh. We found the same kind of prevalence rates. And that is interesting. And I think that gets to other issues on
Absolutely.
The farm, right? Hygiene management, manure management, and we could probably be doing better on those things, even in organic and other production practices. But when you remove the antibiotic use and you note that there is statistically less resistance in that bacteria, well, it's a sort of case in point kind of thing, and we've been pushing that for years, which is we don't need to use all these antibiotics on the farm. Now, when we also looked at the drugs that are approved for use in turkey production and compared those to drugs that were not approved for use in turkey production, you saw much higher resistance in the bacteria to the classes of drugs used in turkey production that were analogous to human drugs. So it all starts to point to when we use them and approve them and use them in a sort of regular way, we're driving up resistance that we're seeing. And so the panels we looked at, again, are not the turkey antibiotics, but rather the resistance that's conferred to the human antibiotic version. In some cases, they're the same, but in some cases, they're a little different. And it's a lesson learned, really, because when you're developing resistance in antibiotics, resistance to one can confer resistance to another antibiotic in that class, and resistance in one organism can be transferred to that same kind of resistance in another organism. And that's the game we're playing out there once we introduce resistance into the environment.
Absolutely incredible. Well, the National Turkey Federation said this in response to your study. This came out the very next day. As soon as you published yours, boy, they had something to say. They said the article is misleading about the significance of its antibiotic findings. One of the antibiotics for which the Consumers Union tested, ciprofloxacin, has not been used in poultry production for almost 8 years, meaning resistance is highly unlikely to be from farm animal use. And two other drug classes, penicillin and cephalosporin, which was only just recently banned from livestock agriculture, are used infrequently in animal ag. The fourth drug class tested by Consumer Reports, tetracycline, is used in animal agriculture but is a largely insignificant antibiotic in human medicine, comprising only 4% of all antibiotics prescribed by physicians. So how do you respond to that?
Well, I think in short how I respond is there is what the Turkey Federation is saying, and there is what the science is saying.
Right.
So in the data, we know that there is a lot of resistance in these bugs. And just because you stop use of certain antibiotics, we expect that resistance to carry over for a little while. In some cases, and you're always looking at the drug-bug combos, it matters. So some of them stay entrenched in resistance. Some will let go of that resistance over time. The lesson is not to myopically look at any one of those relationships and say that's the one that we should follow, but really in using these things over and over again, and it's really the way in which it's like a recipe for antibiotic resistance. If I could think of a really good way to do it, I might take a big lagoon full of manure. I might add a little bit of antibiotics every single day, kind of let it percolate away, not enough to kill the bacteria, but
right.
enough to ping them. And just tease them every day, which causes them to mutate, to get resistant. And then they like to share that with anyone else who comes into the pool. That would be a great recipe. That is what is going on in conventional industrialized farming.
That's right. That's what they call the sub. Dr. Raymond hates it when you say the word subtherapeutic dose. I forget what he kept telling me over and over again what was the actual term he wanted to use.
They have lots of
low dose antibiotics, which is supposed to keep the animals healthy as well as we all know, promote growth. Now, they're dropping that concept of it's promoting growth, and it's just all about keeping them healthy in the conditions in which they live.
That's right, and yet would we ever keep people healthy with antibiotics? Would we keep healthy people healthy using antibiotics?
We all live pretty close together.
Right? We would never, ever do that. In fact, even the FDA, if you go on and you start reading, they give you people a lot of advice. Don't take those antibiotics unless you really, really need them. And you need to be sick with something that is going to be treatable with that antibiotic. Otherwise, you are causing other inadvertent problems. And yet, when it comes to animal production, it's usually no prescription. And there's this slippery slope. You know, everyone is now saying, fine, we won't use it for growth promotion anymore. But the use of low levels to prevent disease, they call it prophylaxis, they call it disease prevention. These are just other terms for the same practice that is causing the same problems, and those, we don't have to do it.
Right. And those drugs are delivered, by the way, in food and water. They're not. It's not like you're inoculating the animals. It's part of a bigger chain, actually, that goes right back to the pharmaceutical industry and the feeds, the companies that provide feed. They all seem to be part of this whole problem, and which is one reason why I could see that there is a huge pushback to change this model, because first of all, the Danish study, which they all point to as something that failed, because they say, and in case people don't know about that, the Danish signed a law into effect about 10 years ago,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
And a lot of EU countries have banned the use of antibiotics in that low level or prophylactic
for
model.
Growth promotion, right?
And so in the Danish study, what they like to point to is a lot more animals got sick. They had a lot more animal mortality. But at the same time, antibiotic resistance did seem to go down, even though they were using overall larger levels of antibiotics to deal with the disease-specific diseases. So can you address a little bit about how... if there are any real studies that point to specifically that low-dose usage... creating the antibiotic resistance microbes versus using it as a high dose that really wipes them out?
Yeah, I mean, there are lots of studies in the scientific literature, and just a quick sort of zip through PubMed and looking at low-level antibiotic use on farms. IATP had done some studies. I think Tara Smith out of Iowa State has also done some studies. And whether you're looking at transference of resistant diseases from animals to people, animals on the farm to people nearby, sometimes the workers, workers
sure, in
are
the
a
hog
great
industry,
way to study
MRSA
them.
Is becoming a real problem.
Absolutely. And so there have most definitely been scientific studies looking at these things. I think where the industry dismisses those out of pocket is a sort of sample size and how do you know? But here's what we do know. We have an intra-agency government program called NARMS, which is the National Antimicrobial Resistance Monitoring System. And the great thing about that is that you have the USDA and the FDA and the CDC sort of looking at the plant, the retail market for meat, as well as the human clinical isolates that are happening for disease-causing infections. And it's a great program. And when we briefed the FDA last week on our ground turkey project, I mean, the good thing is the FDA is actually coming out with stronger and stronger language about their concern. We need that to be followed up with enforceable regulations. But at least acknowledging the problem is the first step. But I think what we also learned is that NARMS captures what's on the package. So if it's saying no antibiotics or organic, it's probably there, but we're not looking at that data. So mm-hmm. we've actually FOIA'd or issued a Freedom of Information request to get that data out of them. We think we have more data that we're sitting on that shows that when we don't use this stuff, we're getting less resistance. And if that's the kind of data we need to get the right policy changes in place, then let's get that out on the table, especially where our taxpayer dollars have actually funded that work.
Oh, most definitely. Let's backtrack. Oh, you know what? Actually, we should probably take a little sponsor drop here, right, Joe? And also let me take this moment to say this program and other programs like this on the air need your dollars to support us. This station is the only one that produces programming like this. You won't hear this on any other mainstream broadband station. So please do look into our webpage and pledge your support to the Heritage Radio Network. And for now, we'll take a quick sponsor drop. We'll be right back with Dr. Urvashi Rangan from Consumer Reports.
This is Chris Howell from Cane Vineyard and Winery. In our industrial world, most wines have become brands, but the wines I love are so much more. Fine wine is a civilizing substance that connects us to nature. It cannot be stamped out in a factory. If you're listening to this great show, you probably eat different. I urge you to drink different too. Go deeper. Cane5.com.
You're listening to Leaving by Dead Stars on the HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Welcome back to What Doesn't Kill You with your host, Katie Kiefer. My guest in the studio today is Dr. Urvashi Rangan from Consumers Union, Consumer Reports. So let's just backtrack for just a second and talk about how and why drug resistance actually develops, because it's quite a complex sort of evolution, and it's even for me, it's kind of hard to wrap my mind around it.
Yeah, it is, and it's really hard because it's not really about the meat itself, per se. Although that doesn't mean that can't contribute. You have drug-resistant organisms on the meat. You don't cook that meat well enough. That one organism doesn't get killed. Your gut can actually perpetrate resistance with that. FDA actually just came out talking about that as well recently, this past week. So that's interesting to note. But the primary mechanism that antibiotic resistance occurs has to do with environmental contamination and pollution from the farms. And so you create these sort of pools of antibiotic resistance on the farms, and you're contaminating the environment, creating these environmental reservoirs. And like I said earlier, the bacteria, once they have the resistant gene, can then throw that gene to other bacteria, and those bacteria can then acquire that gene and that resistance. The gene can also sort of augment and cover other antibiotics that maybe it wasn't initially acquired in the resistance, but now it's broadening because of the spectrum that it's on. And so that, again, you can spread resistance both ways, across bacteria and across antibiotics within classes. And sometimes you can hop classes. And as we were talking earlier, sometimes drugs that are just approved in animals but not used in humans can confer resistance to the human counterpart. So this is what's going on. And the environment, of course, is full of bacteria. And the industry often uses that as a way to say, so you don't need to worry.
And yet you do need to worry about those that, for instance, you mentioned manure and how you would conduct an experiment with that. Most most animal agriculture uses their manure as a fertilizer. It gets spread across fields, and therefore antibiotic resistant microbes are in the soil, sometimes in the water table. They're being picked up by plants, and they're being picked up by birds and wildlife. Is that accurate?
That's accurate to a point. I mean, composting and the process of that is supposed to really address pathogens and killing them. You're supposed to get your compost hot in the middle, and the part of that is using the good bacteria. It generates heat in the compost, and you're trying to kill off that other kind of bacteria. So when we don't have proper composting, then yes, that's a great cocktail to kind of spread that pathogenic bacteria around. And incidentally, the Food Safety Modernization Act actually gives us an opportunity to deal with pathogens in manure compost, and it's something we do need to deal with. Any compost can have this problem, though.
Of course.
So it's important to deal with that. But once it gets in the environment and we become infected, usually later on, not about the piece of meat itself, but later on, you know, just like we catch a cold anywhere we are in the environment. You don't have to be somewhere at a certain time to get that bug. And so once those infections take place, the more resistant those bacteria are, the harder it is to treat those folks who get infected by them. And things like E. coli and Enterococcus that the industry waves off as sort of everywhere and why be bothered, you know, they cause other skin infections, blood infections, so they may not be making you throw up from bad handling of the meat, but they certainly have other disease consequences, and they are infectious organisms. And so to the degree we can mitigate the spread of resistance and even just the prevalence of those, we should be focused on that. We should be looking at that. And yet the industry doesn't even begin to look at those things.
Well, I know that you mentioned something about disclosure, and I want to go back to that because we mentioned it in the first half of the show. But do you feel that the FDA or the pharmaceutical industry is disclosing all that they know, or is it going to require more Freedom of Information Act requests, such as the one you described, in order to evaluate the impact of antibiotics in food production?
Yeah, the regulation of antibiotics is in bad need of an overhaul. And so there's a couple of pieces of legislation. There's the PAMTA Act, which is looking for prudent use of right. antibiotics, and the DATA Act, which is requiring more disclosure. I mean, what's unbelievable, especially for those of us who work on this issue, is that while we may know total sales of antibiotics, and we know 80% of total sales go to the animal agriculture industry every year, most of the drugs go there, we have no idea specifically what species they're going to, specifically what use they're going to. And so the industry sort of hides behind this curtain of a failure to disclose and lobs grenades out from there, suggesting that no one knows what they're talking about when it comes to how they're using them. Well, I guess the suggestion back to them is, well, then let us know so that we can know what you are actually using all of these drugs for. They're not required to report it out.
Right.
It isn't publicly available. But from a scientific perspective, it's incredibly important. Are you using them at low levels all the time? Because that's that pulsing effect that generates the resistance. And, you know, just to go back to the Dutch study, I'll say antibiotics are the tip of the iceberg when it comes to moving our conventional ag systems towards sustainability. We have a lot more to do in terms of animal welfare, how much space they have, making sure they're not standing in each other's feces, making sure we're managing manure. All those things have to come after. You can't just flip the switch. We get that.
Right.
And leave them in their poop. You can't just do that. It requires a lot more to get a handle on this problem. And so we're not stopping at antibiotics. We need systemic changes in conventional industrial food animal production to really get those long-term changes that we're going to need.
Well, as I mentioned before, I did that Animal Agriculture Alliance conference this week, which was titled Activists at the Gate. You know, they... I'm sure they were horrified. they feel very much, you know, that they are being stormed and being abused in the media and so forth and so on. And my message to them was basically, you know, come out from behind the curtain. And one of the things that I said that I think, I mean, the whole antibiotic part of my program was so, I got so much pushback afterwards, even though I was very much complimented on a lot of the other messages. But one of the things that I said, and I'd really believe this, Urvashi, if they believe that this antibiotic use is not deleterious to the human medicine arsenal, then it behooves them, since they've been making so much money off of this for all these many years, it behooves them to fund those studies, to hire a third-party independent entity to create a study that shows that they are not culpable. And you can imagine that did not...
No, I'm sure that did not go over well.
No, not terribly well.
You know, I think, too, it's so divisive, isn't it? Because I think a lot of these companies themselves have no antibiotic lines. They know from a marketing perspective that people want it, so they're going to do it. You know, I always give this example. If everybody wanted blue M&Ms, then there would be just blue M&Ms out there. So now we're talking about a potential serious safety issue, more of a long-term safety issue, and yet companies get indignant about having to change a practice because of that. But they change practices for far less than that.
Sure,
so,
they do.
And then you have these companies with double lines, and they have no antibiotics because they know people will actually pay a little bit more. Maybe they could call them natural, which has no meaning whatsoever, by the way, and doesn't get you to no antibiotics. But all to say that they have those lines, and then there are some serious producers out there that are following this. It is possible. And Nyman Ranch, Organic, these are folks that are not using antibiotics. And it is...
And still have an industrial scale of production.
In some cases, yeah. And then maybe there's some other things to look at, right? Because it's interesting, those prevalence rates are the same. I think the cleaner systems you will get to in the end, and maybe with better welfare, you may start seeing some shifts in the prevalence rates too. And as a scientist, I'm really interested in that. Consumer Reports is really interested in documenting those things because it gives a scientific backbone to what we already think are sensible and sustainable production practices.
Right. Well, to give you some measure of hope, as well as to my listeners, one of the things that I did hear a lot at this Agriculture Alliance event was, first of all, the need for transparency was echoed over and over again. Improving animal welfare standards, again, something that they all are taking very seriously now. They see how damaging these activist videos have been, and they are really working hard, I think, in many cases, especially with the larger firms. Cargill already has a lot of webcams in place. They're monitoring their workers. It's not a third-party audited stream yet, but I wasn't the only person who advocated for that. I know Temple Grandin believes very strongly in that, and a lot of the guys... And I was the only industry outsider at this event. Yeah. So a lot of the insiders were saying the same thing. So that was encouraging to me. And a lot of them have environmental waste management programs, which are very proactive. And I think that they could do a lot more to bring that to the public attention, because that's, I think, a great concern to most people as well. And they are working on that part of it. But boy, the antibiotic thing... Woo! Intransigent on that. Absolutely.
Well, it really is. And I think, you know, when you look at groups that even go beyond what Organic's doing and some of the other ones, the American Grass-Fed Association or Animal Welfare Approved, where you're really now trying to get into those more systemic issues of animal welfare, hygiene management. And look, some of those programs like Animal Welfare Approved allow for antibiotic use for sick animals. And I hope that. I hope that's why we're doing all of this, because we want to make sure that sick animals can be treated for a long time and sick people can too.
Yeah.
And I think that's really the goal here. It isn't to take the bottom out of the meat industry or anything else. It's
right.
to make it better for us and for our kids and for their kids.
And for them. I mean, they, you know, I tried to tell them that if you don't listen to these concerns, you will go the way of the American car industry, like the Pinto or something like that, where, you know, it's like they didn't want to put that rubber bladder in for $3 a copy, and all the cars blew up. I mean, it's like, you got to freaking pay attention to this stuff.
Well, and it's so funny, too, because I'm not sure what the growth promotion rate really is. What's the return rate on all
it's
of this?
It's pretty good, I think, unfortunately.
Well, it's not as much as they thought it was. I think it's more of a mask for just decent hygiene, and it's a Band-Aid for bad sanitation in some cases.
Right.
And, you know, we know from other systems we don't have to do it.
That's right, absolutely. So let's go back to the efforts of Representative Congresswoman Slaughter, Henry Waxman, Rosa DeLauro. They've all been beating the tom-toms, especially Dr. Slaughter has been out in front of this for 7-8 years now. She's brought her motion to the Congress at least 6 times, maybe more, and it never somehow gets any traction in Congress. Do you feel like that there is a growing interest on the part of lawmakers to start addressing this in a more serious way?
You know, I think there's a bigger interest on the part of consumers to want that to happen. And I think that 8 years ago when Congresswoman Slaughter introduced those things, I don't think it was really in the public consciousness.
Right.
And I think that's what's moving, and that's what moves Washington, and that's what moves the market, and that's what moves the companies. And I think that is happening, and people are making those demands. And you know, we do a lot of national surveys and polls,
sure.
and we know people want that meat. They'll pay more for it.
Yep.
And frankly, people care about how their meat's produced, their food's produced, where it was produced, and they have a right to know that information. And it should be done clearly, anonymous-leading way. Natural really shouldn't be allowed on the market,
right.
given it doesn't mean anything. And so I think there is a heightened consciousness. And, you know, for those of us who've been working in food advocacy for a long time, you know that something has to hit the floor of the Congress at least half a dozen times before it's really going to take root. And that's maybe where the optimism ought to be. I think people should be getting engaged in this issue and
Me
weighing
too.
In with their congressmen and congresswomen to let them know that they care. And it's time for these kinds of pieces of legislation to go through.
Now, say one of these pieces of legislation is enacted. How are they going to enforce standards?
Well, this would be the kind of thing then that gets promulgated to one of the agencies. So this is going to be the Food and Drug Administration. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Center for Veterinary Medicine is the one that does the drug animal approvals. And they've been trying to give sort of voluntary guidance to the industry. I think they should be hearing the message loud and clear over at FDA. And if they wanted to step that up at this point, I think that would be more than welcome by consumers and even a number of industry players at this point. But that's where it's going to have to happen. And then we're going to have to make sure that the regs get done properly.
Absolutely. And finally, besides you guys, who else is doing research on this topic besides, you know, either for or against? Like, who are the, who can we point to as other university studies or entities that are doing some of the same kinds of sampling and testing that you're doing?
Well, there's a lot of folks out there working on it. I mean, we're definitely not the only ones. We've got a big megaphone, and so, you know, let's share the stage. But there's plenty of universities. Tara Smith is out there doing stuff, IATP and David Willinga, Johns Hopkins, Keith Nachman's group, Center for Livable Future, Bob Lawrence. There's a lot of people out there doing a lot of good works down in North Carolina near the CAFOs, a lot of good people down there, Steve Wynn. So there are a lot of folks. I think the trick here is whenever you read studies in the literature, it's important to know who funded those studies.
That's right.
Don't rely on headlines alone. We're misled so many times based on a headline on a press release that goes out. My job at Consumer Reports is to make sure we never go flying by the seat of our pants on that. We have to tackle those headlines down and look at the studies themselves, find out what their findings are, how they did it, and knowing who did it is important. It doesn't mean that it's wrong, but knowing that bias that might color a certain interpretation to create a headline that maybe isn't reflective of the study itself is all important to do.
Absolutely. Unfortunately, we have to wrap it up here, Urvashi, but I wanted you to let people know where they can learn more about this on your website.
Yeah, we have a couple of food websites, notinmyfood.org, greenerchoices.org, and we have a label site on there. We have an EcoLabels app that you can download to your iPhone to learn what labels mean something, what labels don't. And we'll be ramping up more as our Food Safety and Sustainability Center starts to grow and grow at Consumer Reports.
That's fantastic. Thank you very much for joining me today, and thank you to my sponsor. And remember, folks, go to our website, pledge your support to Heritage Radio Network so that you can continue to hear from people like Dr. Rangan about this most important public health crisis that is looming over us. Thanks so much for tuning in. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awali, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.